since the Hitler Project was more a means to an end for the deep state, regardless of the outcome of World War II. Following the fall of the Third Reich in 1945, the preparations for the future was already underway. At the surface, a denazification of Germany had to be performed, so the public would believe that the ideas that was at the foundation of Nazism were gone. The initial phase, which began in 1945, involved the removal of high-ranking Nazi officials from positions of power and the dissolution of the Nazi Party. This phase also saw the establishment of military governments in the areas occupied by the Allied powers. The second phase, which began in 1946, involved the more systematic removal of lower-ranking Nazi officials and the confiscation of party property. This phase also saw the establishment of special courts to try individuals accused of war crimes and crimes against humanity. The third phase, which began in the late 1940s, focused on the rehabilitation of Germans who had been involved with the Nazi Party but were not considered major war criminals. This phase involved the establishment of re-education programs and the issuance of clean slates, or certificates that declared an individual's involvement with the party and absolved them of any guilt for their actions. Denazification was a complex and controversial process, and it was met with resistance from some quarters in Germany. Many Germans argued that the process was too harsh and that it punished people who had been forced to join the Nazi Party, or who had been coerced into supporting it. Despite these criticisms, denazification was considered an important step in the process of rebuilding and, as they called it, democratizing Germany after World War II. This also meant that the eugenics agenda, which is at the core of both Nazism and globalism, had to change its shape and form. Listen to episode 15 of our series, Roe v. Wade, The Hidden Agenda, for more background on the twisted ideas around eugenics. There was also the question about public opinion to handle. The public had to be convinced that the main Nazi perpetrators had faced justice. So, they had to put on a show. The Nuremberg trials were a series of legal proceedings that were held in the city of Nuremberg, Germany, after World War II. The trials were held by an international military tribunal and were designed to bring to justice high-ranking Nazi officials who had been involved in crimes against humanity throughout the war. The Nuremberg trials were held in four stages between November 1945 and October 1946. The first trial, which began in November 1945, was known as the Major War Criminals Trial. It involved the prosecution of 24 high-ranking Nazi officials, including Hermann Göring, the former commander-in-chief of the Luftwaffe with major Swedish connections, and Julius Streicher, the editor of the Nazi newspaper Der Stürmer. The second trial, which began in December 1945, was known as the Military Tribunal Trial. It involved the prosecution of six organizations, including the Nazi Party, the Gestapo, and the SS, which were deemed to be criminal organizations. The third and fourth trials, which were held in 1947, were known as the Medical Case and the Einsatzgruppen Case. They involved the prosecution of individuals who had been involved in medical experiments on prisoners and in the mass murder of civilians, respectively. For example, in the Major War Criminals Trial, which began in November 1945 and involved the prosecution of 24 high-ranking Nazi officials, 12 of the defendants were sentenced to death by hanging, 3 were sentenced to life imprisonment, 4 were sentenced to terms of imprisonment ranging from 10 years to 20 years, and 3 were acquitted. In the Military Tribunal Trial, which began in December 1945 and involved the prosecution of 6 organizations, all of the organizations were found guilty and were dissolved. In the Medical Case, which was held in 1947 and involved the prosecution of individuals who had taken part in medical experiments on prisoners, 23 individuals were found guilty and were sentenced to terms of imprisonment ranging from 10 years to life. When public attention was on the show trials in Nuremberg, other preparations was taking place. Among other things, all the strides in eugenics and technology that the Nazis had made had to somehow be secured, or the deep state would lose years of precious research. Operation Paperclip was a secret program carried out by the United States at the end of World War II. It was designed to recruit both scientists, engineers, and technical experts from Germany and bring them to the United States to work on advanced military and technological projects. The program was initiated by the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, the precursor to the CIA, and was later taken over by the Joint Intelligence Objectives Agency, which was created with the sole purpose of running the paperclip operation. It was named Operation Paperclip because the scientists' records were kept on paperclips. The operation was carried out in the aftermath of World War II, as the United States and its allies sought to prevent the Soviet Union from recruiting the German scientists and gaining a technological advantage. This was at least the official explanation. Many of the scientists who were recruited had been members of the Nazi Party and had worked on projects for the German military, including the development of rocket technology and chemical weapons. One notable name is Wernher von Braun, who worked on several high-profile projects, including the creation of NASA and development of the Redstone rocket, which was used to launch the first American satellite. He was also involved in the development of the Saturn V rocket, which was used to launch the Apollo spacecraft and land astronauts on the moon. Von Braun also played a key role in the development of the space shuttle. He died in 1977, at the age of 65. Operation Paperclip was indeed a top-secret program, so it was not officially acknowledged by the United States government for many years. It was not until the 1970s, when information about the program was leaked to the press, that the full extent of the operation began to be publicly known. The program was officially declassified in 1973, when the CIA released documents related to Operation Paperclip as part of a Freedom of Information Act request. These documents provided more information about the program and the individuals who had been recruited as part of it. However, it is likely that not all information about the operation has been made public, as many government documents related to national security matters are still classified and not available to the public. In order for the deep state to continue exploiting both sides in a major conflict, to their own benefit and long-term goals of introducing totalitarian globalism, two relatively matched sides in terms of perceived strength had to be constructed. The war against Nazism was over and another enemy had to be introduced. And since the deep state had already in 1917 put the Bolsheviks in power in the Soviet Union, one doesn't have to think long as to why. Enter the threat of communism and the fear of the atom bomb. NATO, or the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, was created in the aftermath of World War II as a way to strengthen the bonds between the Western democracies and to provide a collective defense against the threat of Soviet expansion. The organization was founded on April 4, 1949, with the signing of the North Atlantic Treaty by 12 countries: Belgium, Canada, Denmark, France, Iceland, Italy, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, Norway, Portugal, the United Kingdom, and the United States. The idea of NATO was first proposed by U.S. Secretary of State George Marshall in a speech given at Harvard University in 1947. In the speech, Marshall called for a plan to help rebuild the economies of Europe and to create a shield against aggression to prevent the spread of communism. Marshall had, strangely enough, in that same year been to China in support for Mao Zedong and the communists in the Chinese Civil War. Nothing is as it seems. The NATO proposal was met with widespread support, and negotiations for the North Atlantic Treaty began in 1948. The treaty established the principles of collective defense and mutual assistance, as well as the principle of non-interference in the internal affairs of member countries. It also established the NATO Council, which was responsible for making decisions on military and political strategy, and the NATO Military Committee, which was responsible for coordinating military operations. The official story is that NATO has played a significant role in a number of conflicts and peacekeeping operations over the years, and has also been involved in disaster relief efforts and the promotion of stability and security in other parts of the world. Almost seems like a big joke, played on the unsuspecting public. The organization has evolved over time and has expanded to include 30 member countries in Europe and North America. The Warsaw Pact was a military alliance of Eastern European communist countries, established in 1955 in response to the formation of NATO. The member countries of the Warsaw Pact were Albania, Bulgaria, Czechoslovakia, East Germany, Hungary, Poland, Romania, and the Soviet Union. The Warsaw Pact was created as a way for the Soviet Union and its satellite states to counter the perceived threat of NATO, which was seen as a military alliance of Western democracies. The pact provided for the collective defense of member countries and established a centralized command structure for military operations. So, NATO was created long before any sign of any great communist threat. The Warsaw Pact played a significant role in the Cold War, as it was seen as a means for the Soviet Union to exert its influence over Eastern Europe and to counter the influence of NATO. The pact was also involved in a number of conflicts and peacekeeping operations, including the invasion of Czechoslovakia in 1968 and the Soviet-Afghan War in the 1980s. Controlling both sides in the Cold War sure was a grand plan. What is a keystone? What nation dominates all others? What nation has influence over most others? What nation has used its neutral status to control both sides? Who acts without being seen? Look at the map and see if you can spot it, the keystone. The Warsaw Pact was dissolved in 1991, following the collapse of the Soviet Union at the end of the Cold War. The member countries of the pact either joined NATO or became neutral countries. Since the inception of NATO, the US military has been used as the white hand of the military-industrial complex, which is in itself the military arm of the deep state. Many conflicts have since been created, and major continuous pushes of the public opinion, in order for the deep state to further its goals, where military action was necessary. In Europe, the Cold War was always intended to provide a stalemate, with the threat of the atom bomb looming over the horizon, while the so-called war against communism was waged elsewhere on the planet. As always, it's all really about control of natural resources, domination, and control of the population. When the Cold War ended, and the war against communism could no longer be maintained, the deep state shifted its focus, from communism as the main antagonist, to warfare under more religious pretenses. 9/11 was the main catalyst into shaping the public's opinion in favor of a war against an abstract noun. Terrorism. Al-Qaeda was the facade of choice, created by Osama bin Laden in 1988 at the end of the Soviet-Afghan War. Osama bin Laden was a wealthy Saudi businessman and a member of a powerful family with connections to the Saudi royal family, and most probably a CIA asset. The Saudi royal family were nothing but puppets of the deep state, right up until Mohammed bin Salman, on Sunday, November 4, 2017, detained hundreds of Saudi royals, billionaires, and senior government officials in Hotel Ritz-Carlton, in Riyadh. This was a shakedown operation and a power consolidation operation, said one former senior US official, who was in office at the time. It surely was just that. The deep state puppet strings had been severed. The involuntary guests were told that they had to sign away large chunks of their assets if they wanted to be released. Saudi billionaire Mohammed Al-Amoudi spent 400 days in detention before he was released. If you want, spend some time researching the connection between a man called Bunder bin Sultan and the Bush family. You might be surprised how deep the connections go between the American arm of the deep state and its Saudi counterparts. So, in the wake of 9/11, the war against terrorism was started. Natural resources in the form of opium and oil from Afghanistan and Iraq was primarily in the crosshairs of the deep state. Since then, more manufactured religious extremist groups has been spawned, such as ISIS. As we can now clearly see, history is somewhat being unraveled in reverse. We're faced once more with Nazism. Both in terms of an obvious villain in Klaus Schwab and the World Economic Forum, and in the form of neo-Nazi Ukrainian military and paramilitary groups. At this point, the deep state is pretty much exposing itself through a completely idiotic proxy war against Russia. From the Maidan Revolution in 2014, the US State Department and CIA staged a coup to overthrow the government in the Ukraine. The neo-Nazi Azov Battalion were used as muscle, and the regiment was supplied with weapons from the military-industrial complex, and still are. The Azov Battalion and regiment received backing from Ukraine's interior minister in 2014, as the government had recognized its own military was too weak to fight off the pro-Russian separatists, and relied on paramilitary volunteer forces. These forces were privately funded by oligarchs, the most known being Igor Kolomoisky, an energy magnate billionaire and then governor of the Dnipropetrovsk region. The fact that a Jewish oligarch is funding neo-Nazi paramilitary forces should give some pause for thought. In addition to Azov, Kolomoisky funded other volunteer battalions such as the Dnipro 1 and Dnipro 2, Ada and Donbass units. Azov received early funding and assistance from another oligarch, Serhiy Taruta, the billionaire governor of Donetsk region. In 2015, Andriy Diachenko, the spokesperson for the regiment at the time, said that 10 to 20% of Azov's recruits were Nazis. The unit has denied publicly that it adheres to Nazi ideology, but Nazi symbols such as the swastika and SS regalia are rife on the uniforms and bodies of Azov members. For example, the uniform carries the neo-Nazi Wolf's Angel symbol, which is a black swastika on a yellow background. In January 2018, Azov rolled out its street patrol unit called National Druzhina to restore order in Ukraine's capital. Instead, the unit carried out pogroms, which is a violent riot, incited with the aim of massacring or expelling an ethnic or religious group, particularly Jews. In this case, they went after the Roma community and attacked members of the LGBTQ community. Maybe that's something to bear in mind for all the people flying the Ukrainian flag together with the pride flag in their bio on social media. Ukraine is the world's only nation to have a neo-Nazi formation in its armed forces, a correspondent for the US-based magazine called The Nation wrote in 2019. How could the neo-Nazi movement get such influence in the Ukraine? Well, let's have a listen to a leaked intercepted conversation between Victoria Nuland, lead US point person for the 2014 Maidan Revolution, and Jeffrey Pyatt, the United States ambassador to Ukraine. The call took place in January 2014, right before the protest movement started to escalate.
What do you think?
I think we're in play. The Klitschko piece is obviously the complicated electron here. Especially the announcement of him as deputy prime minister, and you've seen some of my notes on the troubles in the marriage right now, so we're trying to get a read really fast on where he is on this stuff. But I think your argument to him, which you'll need to make, I think that's the next phone call we want to set up, is exactly the one you made to Yats. And I'm glad you sort of put him on the spot on where he fits in this scenario, and I'm very glad he said what he said in response.
Good. So I don't think Cleach should go into the government. I don't think it's necessary. I don't think it's a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you think, what in terms of him not going into the government, just let him sort of stay out and do his political homework and stuff. I'm just thinking, in terms of sort of the process moving ahead, we want to keep the moderate Democrats together. The problem is going to be Tanibok and his guys. And, you know, I'm sure that's part of what Yanukovych is calculating on all of this.
I think Yats is the guy who's got the economic experience, the governing experience. He's the guy, you know, what he needs is Cleach and Tanibok on the outside. He needs to be talking to them four times a week. You know, I just think Cleach going in, he's going to be at that level working for Yatsenyuk. It's just not going to work.
I think that's right. Okay. Good. Well, do you want us to try to set up a call with him as the next step?
My understanding from that call, but you tell me, was that the big three were going into their own meeting and that Yats was going to offer in that context a three-way, you know, the 3+1 conversation or 3+2 with you. Is that not how you understood it?
No, I mean, that's what he proposed. But I think just knowing the dynamic that's been with them where Klitschko has been the top dog, he's going to take a while to show up for whatever meeting they've got. And he's probably talking to his guys at this point. So I think you reaching out directly to him helps with the personality management among the three, and it gives you also a chance to move fast on all this stuff and put us behind it before they all sit down and he explains why he doesn't like it.
Okay, good. I'm happy. Why don't you reach out to him and see if he wants to talk before or after?
Okay, will do. Thanks.
Okay, I've now written, one more wrinkle for you, Jeff.
Yeah.
I can't remember if I told you this or if I only told Washington this, that when I talked to Jeff Feltman this morning, he had a new name for the UN guy, Robert Seri. Did I write you that this morning?
Yeah, okay. I saw that.
He's now gotten both Seri and Ban Ki-moon to agree that Seri could come in Monday or Tuesday.
Okay.
So that would be great, I think, to help glue this thing and have the UN help glue it and, you know, fuck the EU.
No, exactly. And I think we've got to do something to make it stick together, because you can be pretty sure that if it does start to gain altitude, the Russians will be working behind the scenes to try to torpedo it. And again, the fact that this is out there right now, I'm still trying to figure out in my mind why Yanukovych did that. But in the meantime, there's a Party of Regions faction meeting going on right now, and I'm sure there's a lively argument going on in that group at this point. But anyway, we could land Jelly set up on this one if we move fast. So let me work on Klitschko, and if you can just keep, I think we want to try to get somebody with an international personality to come out here and help to midwife this thing. And then the other issue is some kind of outreach to Yanukovych, but we probably regroup on that tomorrow as we see how things start to fall into place.
So on that piece, Jeff, when I wrote the note, Sullivan's come back to me via VFR saying, you need Biden, and I said, probably tomorrow for an attaboy and to get the deets to stick. So
okay.
Biden's willing.
Okay, great.
All right.
Thanks.
Is this a round sound in a two-inch wall? I was waiting for the communist call. I didn't ask for sunshine, and I got one more free. I'm looking over the wall, and they're looking at me.
Of course, it's all just a conspiracy theory. What about the Ukraine and biological weapons? Just another conspiracy theory. Right? But let's make sure and check in with Victoria Nuland again. The following recording is from a hearing in the U.S. Senate in March of 2022.
I only have a minute left. Let me ask you, does Ukraine have chemical or biological weapons?
Ukraine has biological research facilities, which, in fact, we are now quite concerned Russian troops, Russian forces may be seeking to gain control of. So we are working with the Ukrainians on how they can prevent any of those research materials from falling into the hands of Russian forces should they approach.
I'm sure you're aware that the Russian propaganda groups are already putting out there all kinds of information about how they've uncovered a plot by the Ukrainians to release biological weapons in the country and with NATO's coordination. If there's a biological or chemical weapon incident or attack inside of Ukraine, is there any doubt in your mind that 100% it would be the Russians that would be behind it?
There is no doubt in my mind, Senator, and it is classic Russian technique to blame on the other guy what they're planning to do themselves.
Add to this all the corruption that has taken place in the Ukraine since 2014. Consider the dealings of Joe Biden, John Kerry, Nancy Pelosi, and many others. Then we haven't even touched on Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama. But let's just say that Hunter Biden's laptop is just the tip of the iceberg. Though there are many questions still unanswered, we can at this point clearly see that the deep state is exposing itself, its history, and its own players for all to see. All you have to do is look. In 2016, Facebook first designated the Azov Regiment a dangerous organization. Under the company's Dangerous Individuals and Organizations policy, Azov was banned from its platforms in 2019. The group was placed under Facebook's Tier 1 designation, which includes groups such as the Ku Klux Klan and ISIS. Users engaging in praise, support, or representation of Tier 1 groups are also banned. However, on February 24, the day Russia launched its invasion, Facebook reversed its ban, saying it would allow praise for Azov. I wonder why that is. Maybe, just maybe, someone wants us to connect the dots. If you've followed us over all our episodes, you realize that this journey we're on, it isn't over just yet, and we will soon find ourselves face to face with the best-kept secret of the deep state. All roads may lead to Rome, but all the fiber cables lead to Sweden. Maybe we will have a denazification for real, this time around, with actual trials and tribunals. And maybe, just maybe, the bad people will actually have to answer for their crimes.